It was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning an era that saw the Alamo, the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War come and go. It was the 60 years of ongoing battles, fights, and raids that took place between the Great Plains nomadic horse warriors and settlers, traders, and the United States military. With as many as 20,000 casualties on each side, it made the Wild Wild West a dangerous and violent place. It is simply called the Indian Wars. People have occupied the Americas for perhaps as long as 40,000 years. Over these years, they have created great civilizations equaling any found in Europe, Asia, and Africa. In North America, Paleo-Indians hunted the mammoths and mastodons. They were replaced by archaic Indians who lived from 5,000 to 1,000 BC. They left behind remarkable cave art. In at least one instance, they hunted bison, the species known as the American buffalo, by driving them into kill sites on the eastern Colorado plains. But these hunter-gatherers were moving towards becoming agricultural societies. Prior to the arrival of Europeans in 1492, the transition to agrarian cultures had been nearly completed. Indian nations extended across North America. A network of cities flourished as a part of a mound-building culture in the east. In the southwest, the Anasazi and their contemporary cultures built equally remarkable dwellings. Then in the historical blink of an eye, they all disappeared and were replaced by the configuration of tribes in place at the start of the 17th century, many of which then vanished as a result of European diseases and settlement. During this time, the great cities were replaced by small agricultural villages. Then, as the Europeans expanded across the continent, the surviving tribes were pushed ever westward into a constantly redefined and shrinking Indian territory. However, during the middle of the 18th century, two parallel events occurred on the North American continent. The creation of a new type of nation, the United States of America, and the creation of a new kind of Indian culture, the warrior horse culture. Two remarkable human transformations that would eventually clash in bitter conflict. Two large mammal species played an equally critical role in creating the remarkable Plains Indians culture. One was the horse, an animal brought to the New World by the Europeans. The other, a member of the cattle family, was the American buffalo, indigenous to the continent. The American buffalo can trace its ancestry back to the Pleistocene era, when its relatives roamed among the mastodons, mammoths, giant wolves, and lions. In fact, the buffalo is the lone survivor from that ancient time. A herd animal, the buffalo is covered with long, dark brown woolly hair. It has a massive head, high humped shoulders, and a tufted tail. Fully grown, buffaloes are 5 to 6 feet high at the shoulders and can weigh as much as a ton. Like other members of the cattle family, they thrive on grasses. Prior to the 1800s, it is estimated that the buffalo population ranged somewhere between 60 to 80 million. They were found wherever prairie grasses grew, from Canada to Texas, and from the Rockies to Ohio and Kentucky. It was said that when one of the vast herds moved through an area, it kicked up a cloud of dust, darkening the sky. For 10,000 years, buffalo had been hunted on foot by the Native American tribes, but were never the principal source of food and material for the Indian, as the deer or elk were. That changed with the arrival of the Europeans and their horses. The horse was particularly important to the Spanish in their conquests and explorations. The Spanish Iberian Mustang was not a huge grain-fed animal like the horses from northwestern Europe and the British Isles. It was a desert-bred animal that could live entirely off grasses and go for long periods without water. It was capable of carrying a man in heavy armor over miles of burning desert and dry high plains. In 1680, there was a massive uprising by the Pueblo Indians against their Spanish overlords. When the surviving Spanish fled, they left behind their sheep, cattle, and horses. The Pueblo, a sedentary people having little use for the thousands of Spanish horses, simply let them roam free. These horses, thriving on the short grass prairies, formed the nucleus of the great Mustang herds of the Southwest and Southern Plains. This great horse dispersal produced, perhaps, the most rapid cultural transformation hitherto ever witnessed on the planet. Within 100 years, a number of Native American tribes on both sides of the Great Plains had transformed themselves into nomadic, buffalo-hunting horse cultures. Horse cultures with names like the Cheyenne, the Sioux, the Comanche, the Kiowa, and the Arapaho. One 100 years after the Great Horse Dispersal started, most of the remaining North American tribes had horses, but only a few tried the grand economic experiment of developing a true nomadic horse culture. At the same time, the short grass prairie offered a huge unoccupied region for expansion. While unfit for permanent settlement, it was ideal for any group that moved easily with the wanderings of the millions of buffalo. The horse provided the vehicle, and the buffalo provided a virtually inexhaustible supply of high-quality protein, giving the tribes willing to venture onto the plains the chance for rapid population growth. Each of these tribes has a unique story of its transformation into a horse culture. The why has long been lost, but the journey has been recorded. Looking at the Great Plains as a sea of prairie grass, all the eventual nomadic tribes started in the north, 3 from the eastern shore and 4 from the western shore. Unlike the other horse cultures, the Navajo and Apache moved into their 18th and 19th century homelands prior to the arrival of the Europeans in the 16th century. They were part of a very large subarctic group generally referred to as the Athabascan-speaking Indians. Their ancestral home covered a large part of Canada's Northwest Territory. Anthropological records indicate these people lived in small family groups, were nomadic, and hunted caribou. Sometime between 900 and 1400 AD, a group identified as the Southern Athabascans migrated south into present-day West Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. When the Spanish arrived in 1540, they were already split into two distinct groups, the Apache and the Navajo. Each had their own territories and customs. And because of their close proximity to the Spanish, they were the first to tame horses. In fact, in 1659, the Navajo were the first Indians to attack Europeans using horses. At the same time, their Apache relatives used the horse for food and as a beast of burden. The Navajo were more settled than the Apache. Like most tribes who had names for themselves, such as the True Ones, Only Ones, Real People, and Human Beings, the Navajo referred to themselves as Diné, meaning the people. They lived in permanent dwellings known as hogans. These eight-sided buildings were perfect for the desert southwest, remaining hot in the winter and cool in the summer. Capturing horses, sheep, and goats from the Spanish, the Navajo established herds of their own. They became excellent weavers, and their rugs and blankets became highly valued trade goods. The most important person in the Navajo family was the woman, who owned the land, the home, and the livestock. All Navajo life centered around the family, including religious ceremonies. One of the most important was a healing ceremony known as the Night Way. In this ceremony, the Navajo used sand paintings like this one to heal the sick. Shamans, called singers, created these sacred pictures using crushed rock of many colors. While the Navajo practiced more settled activities like farming, the Apache preferred raiding and hunting. Indeed, the Apache moved seasonally with the antelope, elk, deer, and buffalo. Traveling in small groups or as individual families, they would set up a circular hut known as a wickiup. Each wickiup housed a family. From these camps, the Apache raided the Spanish or other tribes, capturing sheep and goats, which they ate, and mustangs, which they used primarily as pack horses. The Apache, though they numbered less than 5,000, were among the most warlike of the Indians and had long-running feuds with almost every other tribe of the southern plains and desert southwest. They formed no religious institutions, but looked for spirituality in everyday life. The famous Chiricahua leader, Geronimo, who was also a healer, explained, "We had no churches, no Sabbath day, no holidays, and yet we worshipped. Sometimes the whole tribe would assemble to sing and pray. Sometimes in a smaller number, perhaps only two or three. Sometimes an aged person prayed for all of us." Unlike later arrivals to the plains, neither the Apache nor the Navajo formed any significant military alliances with other tribes. The Kiowa's journey onto the plains began somewhere in the Kootenay region of British Columbia, Canada. From there, they migrated into western Montana in the 1600s. Around 1700, they reached the Yellowstone River area. 10 years later, after acquiring the horse from the Crow, they found a home in South Dakota's Black Hills. Very quickly, the Cheyenne and the Sioux drove them from this home. Again, they moved south, where they fought a bloody war with the Comanche. However, by the beginning of the 19th century, the Kiowa formed a strong military alliance with their former adversary. This alliance was at the center of the battle for the southern plains. Their language is believed to be part of the Aztec Tinoan linguistic stock. It is a language grouping spoken by many Mexican Indians. Like all the nomadic Indian nations, the twin centers of Kiowa life were hunting and war. Though small in numbers, the Kiowa were known for their exceptional bravery, strict military organization, and strong warrior societies. The Kiowa were also known for their incredible storytelling pictographs. Indeed, they came very close to developing a written language. Much history of the Indian Wars comes from their pictographic records written on buffalo hides as a kind of yearly calendar. Another nation, later called the Kiowa Apache, accompanied the Kiowa as they migrated south. Though unrelated genealogically to either the Kiowa or Apache, they had the cultural traits of the Kiowa and spoke an Athabascan-based language like the Apache, hence the Kiowa Apache designation. Their Uto-Aztecan language places the Comanche as part of the Shoshone Nation that occupied a large part of the Great Basin area of Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada. Sometime in the 17th century, a small band of Shoshone from the mountainous region of Wyoming migrated south along the Rocky Mountains. Around 1700, they acquired horses, and by 1720, they were in present-day Kansas. By this time, they had become the finest horse breeders on the plains, owning the largest and richest herds of Indian ponies in the West. For the next 150 years, the Comanche would lord over the most expansive Native American empire the continent would ever see. Master horse warriors, the Comanche fought and defeated the Apache and the Spanish. It is said that the Comanche killed more whites than any other Indian tribe. Eventually, they formed military alliances with the Kiowa and the Southern Arapaho and the Southern Cheyenne. Although the Comanche controlled a large empire that stretched across the southern plains, they were less organized socially than their Kiowa allies, but organized in small bands of 100 or so warriors. The Comanche rivaled the Spanish conquistadors in wealth and power. Like the Spanish, they were also slave traders and profit seekers. Of all the Plains nations, the Comanche were the most open to new ideas. It was perhaps their greatest strength. According to historians Joseph Cash and Gerald Wolfe in their book The Comanche People, the Comanche, by bringing in captives from so many different groups, kept their nation vigorous and far-seeing. But while the Comanche were far-seeing, they also recognized the value of the old traditions, such as using spider webs to tell when a storm was approaching, thus enabling them to use the weather to their advantage during raids or hunting. A second group of Indians moved onto the plains, not from the northwest as did the Apache, Navajo, Kiowa, and Comanche, but from the northeast. At one time, both the Cheyenne and Arapaho were part of a large village-dwelling group of Indian nations known as the Woodland Culture that lived in the upper Great Lakes region of the United States. The Cheyenne and Arapaho were both Algonquin-speaking people. The exact ancestral homeland of the Arapaho is unknown, but many believe they once lived along the banks of the Red River between the border of North Dakota and Minnesota. Sometime in the 1700s, the Arapaho arrived near the headwaters of the Missouri River. From the headwaters of the Missouri, the Arapaho pushed south towards the Black Hills. Though they made a military and economic alliance with the Cheyenne, they warred with the rest of the Plains tribes, including the Sioux, Pawnee, Comanche, and the Shoshone. In fact, it was by stealing their horses that the Arapaho became a full-fledged horse culture. The Arapaho practiced and perhaps originated the Sun Dance. An annual event, the Sun Dance was a test of endurance for the participants, as they had to dance and perform rituals for days, often staring into the sun. While the Arapaho were fierce fighters, they were known more for their welcoming ways than their warlike nature. This characteristic stemmed from their form of government, which used consensus to make decisions for the tribe. Usually, consensus was reached among the adult men and some of the elderly women. Unlike the Comanche, who did not allow women to have any authority at all, elderly Arapaho women held the authority on religious matters. When a child was born, the umbilical cord was placed in a special beaded case and attached to the child's cradle as an amulet. When the child learned to walk, he or she carried the amulet with them wherever they went. The first historical record of the Cheyenne was in 1680, when a group of Cheyenne encountered the French explorer La Salle in present-day Illinois. Shortly after this encounter, the Cheyenne moved westward, separating from their woodland neighbors. Still living in permanent villages, they farmed along the Missouri River in North and South Dakota during the mid-1700s. But at century's end, they had lost the corn, as their legend told, and became a true nomadic horse culture. For a brief period, they occupied the Black Hills, only to be pushed out by the Sioux. Perhaps the most important Cheyenne ceremony was the Medicine Arrow Rite, also known as the Arrow Renewal Ceremony. At the end of spring, the Cheyenne arranged their teepees in a crescent with a great medicine lodge at its center. Then, for 4 days, the entire tribe concentrated on renewing the power of their weapons through 4 sacred arrows, which were thought to have supernatural power over men and buffalo. In the 1830s, some Cheyenne and Arapaho gravitated to the trading post at Bent's Fort on the Arkansas River, while others preferred to trade on the Missouri and Platte. The two groups eventually made an informal division. Eventually, the Northern Cheyenne and Arapaho would ally themselves with the Sioux in the battle for the Northern Plains, and the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho would align themselves with the Kiowa and the Comanche in the battle for the Southern Plains. It has been said that no tribe suffered more during the Indian Wars than the Cheyenne. Horse-mounted, riding into battle against the cavalry, wearing long buffalo robes, smoking the peace pipe in a colorfully painted teepee. For most Americans today, these are the images of what the American Indian was like. These are actually images of only the Plains Indians, more than likely the Sioux. The Sioux, also known as the Lakota, the Dakota, and the Nakota, were originally a woodland Indian tribe that dominated the southern two-thirds of Minnesota, as well as parts of Wisconsin, Iowa, and North and South Dakota. Unlike the neighboring Algonquin-speaking woodland Indians, the Sioux spoke their own language, Siouan. There were 4 ancestral branches of the Sioux: the Santee, which was made up of 4 distinct bands, the Yankton, with only 1 band, the Yanktonai, formed from 3 bands, and the largest and best known branch of the Sioux, the Teton, also known as the Lakota. It included the Ogallala band, the Brule, the Hunkpapa, the Minikanju, and 3 lesser known bands. It was the Lakota branch that first gained the horse and spread west to the Black Hills and beyond. It was the Teton branch that became one of the most formidable combatants in the Indian Wars. And it was the Teton who had the greatest number of warriors on the plains and inflicted the greatest defeats on the United States cavalry. Aside from their warlike prowess, among the plains nations, the Sioux were known for their kindness, charity, and brotherhood. Each plains nation had its own creation myth, in its own sacred person or spirit who came to earth and gave it the traditions necessary for a healthy life. According to Sioux legend, a white buffalo maiden came to them bearing a pipe and instructions on how to live. The pipe represented the covenant between the Sioux and the buffalo. Like the Kiowa, the Sioux kept a pictographic record of their history known as the Winter Count. Drawn on buffalo skins, it recorded the momentous events of the year with a single picture. 3 other tribes became expert horsemen living at the edges of the Great Plains. They were the Crow, the Blackfeet, and the Pawnee. While they participated in the Indian Wars, they never developed a true nomadic lifestyle. By the start of the sustained fighting that culminated in the final phase of the Indian Wars, the Plains Indian tribes had settled into stable territories. By this time, the 7 tribes, while retaining a number of distinctive features such as language, shared many customs and ways derived from becoming nomadic, buffalo hunting, horse-oriented cultures. There was no more dramatic sight on the plains than hundreds of teepees silhouetted against the setting sun. Life on the plains for the Indian nations that followed the buffalo required a living structure that was big enough to hold a family, was warm in the winter and cool in the summer, sturdy against the fierce prairie winds, and perhaps most importantly, the Plains Indians needed a structure that was readily transportable, easily assembled and disassembled. The teepee fit these needs perfectly. In the Sioux language, teepee meant dwelling. The Upper Great Lakes tribes had smaller versions of the teepees seen in historic photographs. Teepee size for those early Indians was restricted by the lack of carrying capacity of the domestic dogs that were used for transportation. That restriction was removed with the arrival of the horse. The materials for a teepee came from the buffalo and the lodge poles cut from pine woods. Gathering these materials, hunting the buffalo and cutting and trimming the lodge poles was done by the men. The rest of the work was done by the women. Not only did the women tan the hides and sew them together, they were also responsible for putting up the teepees. The basic design of the teepee was remarkably simple. Buffalo hides stretched over a framework of lodge poles. Erecting a teepee was simple as well. First, three poles formed the tripod base to which additional poles were added. When this was done, the cover, perhaps made up of as many as 20 buffalo hides, was lifted into place and secured at the top. The bottom edge was pegged to the ground, and the entrance flap was put in place with more wooden pegs. The last two poles were used to control the smoke flaps. The unexpected sight of even a lone warrior appearing at the horizon struck fear in the hearts of travelers and cavalry soldiers alike. The paintings on his horse and the number of feathers in his hair showed how powerful a fighter he was. Dressed in the colorful regalia of his tribe, wearing the war paint that indicated he was ready to die in battle, this single warrior might mean hundreds more lay hidden in ambush, or he might just want to trade. Like the teepee, whose shape was both practical and symbolic, so were the Indians' clothes. In summer, the breech clout and simple leggings were perfect for the desert-like heat of the plains. In winter, the heavy fur and tough hide of the buffalo kept him warm in even the most frigid conditions. The markings on his clothing indicated which tribe he was from and his prowess as a warrior. The animal skins used to make his garments showed which spirit guides he looked to for personal power. While a warrior took the utmost care with his appearance when on a raid, it was the women who made all the clothing for the family. The buffalo, the all-purpose beast of the plains, was the source of most clothing. Deer and antelope also provided skins for garments. As trade with the white man increased, factory-made cloth, blankets, and even boots were used by the plains Indians. Still, the buffalo remained the most important source of clothing right up to the end of the Indian Wars. The buffalo's tough hide was used to make robes, caps, moccasins, leggings, mittens, coats, and dresses. Women left the fur on for winter garments and removed it for summer clothes. While in camp, men and women dressed simply for freedom of movement. However, on important ceremonial days, they dressed in their finest clothes with the tribe's distinctive quill and beadwork on display. In colder weather, the warrior wore leggings for warmth. He also wore leggings when hunting or on a raiding party to protect his legs. Leggings were colorful and profusely decorated with paint, bells, shells, quills, or beads. It was as a warrior in a raiding party that the men displayed their finest garments. Within each tribe, distinctive decorations indicated specific warrior societies. However, individual warriors used paint to show their personal war honors. Ceremonial shirts, generally known as a war shirt, were extensively decorated and worn during raiding parties. These shirts hung loose and fell well below the waist. The northern tribes, such as the Sioux, had the most glorious war shirts. The Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Kiowa painted celestial symbols on their war shirts. Generally, the southern tribes were less adorned. An Indian's hair was deemed directly related to the soul, and as such was treated as an adornment. While on a raid, it was often decorated with beads and colors to make it distinctive. Warriors who had counted coups in battle would wear eagle feathers as a mark of their bravery. The Sioux wore their hair loose as a sign of humility. Some southern and central plains tribes shaved their heads except for a short tuft. They often then painted the head as well as the face red. In the golden age of the plains Indians warrior culture, their costumes were among the finest ever made, showing distinctive beauty and personality. It was the well-ordered social structure of the seven Indian nations that enabled them to thrive in the harsh environment of the plains and desert, and battle the U.S. military to a standstill for nearly 40 years. It was a social structure that was organized into groupings within groupings. At its base was the family. The next largest group was the extended family, called a clan. After the clans came camps or villages. A camp could be made up of a single clan or a band, which consisted of multiple clans. Sometimes these clans would be related by marriage, and sometimes not. Villages, in turn, were spread out over a tribe's territory. Depending upon the time of year, the village could be as small as 20 or fewer people, or large enough to stretch along a river for 15 miles. Life in camp revolved around the teepee. Women did all of the tasks that made the household run. They collected firewood and cooked meals, gathered suitable roots and fruits, scraped buffalo and antelope hides, prepared buffalo meat for drying, and made all the clothing from moccasins to breeches. The women took care of the children until 5 or 6 years of age, often nursing them for the whole time. At that point, young boys went to help their fathers with the pony herds, and young girls followed their mothers, learning what it meant to be a good wife and mother. But while seemingly engaged in menial tasks, women were not considered servants. They had their role and scorned men's help. The man was the head of the household. His job was to hunt and fight, tasks that inevitably took their toll. So much so that there were many more women than there were men in a typical clan. The result was, tribes practiced polygamy, and a man, if he survived the hunt and battle, could have several wives in order to maintain population numbers of a clan at a functional level. In fact, clans and bands operated with a great deal of independence, particularly when it came to interactions with other Indians and whites. Because Indian nations were spread out over a large area, it was important to have events that brought them together to solidify their tribal and band identity, and to plan tribal and band activities such as warfare. These events took the form of ceremonies, feasts, and dances. For example, celebrations meant huge bonfires, drumming and dancing far into the night. During summer encampments, bonfires might go on for weeks at a time as the entire community gathered to witness feats of daring through the dance steps of the participants. The throbbing of the drum and the movement of the dances celebrated victories, hunts, marriages, planting seasons, and harvests. Indians had a song for every event, from odes to a warrior's horse to a death song that he might sing during a battle. It was all part of their own unique religion. To the Plains Indians, everything in the world served a purpose in their lives. The sun, the mountains, the animals, the rivers, the trees. Everything in a warrior's natural environment had a connection to the Creator, and therefore was filled with its own mysterious force. God, or the Creator, or the Great Spirit, was not separate from the earth. This meant everything was sacred. The many rituals and ceremonies of the tribe connected its members to the earth and everything in it, as well as to the Creator of all things. As a result, the Plains Indians believed that they could, through ritual, directly connect and participate with God or the spirit world. The most important ritual for every warrior was the vision quest. The quest lasted from 2 to 4 days, and included fasting, staying awake, and crying for help from the spirits.
That drum is the centerpiece of the whole powwow. It's like the earth. The earth is round. And everything in that circle, it touches.
When you go in, like we are like now, you go in, you come in into this, but when it closes up, you can't see here or anything. So what's going to happen? You're going to, once somebody tells you, you're in your mother's womb, and you have no clothes, you're naked. So when you go out, when this opens up, you don't run out. You're going to crawl out. I guarantee you. Because of what happened in here. So when you crawl out like when you were a baby. See? So when you take the water and spit it on yourself, you took everything and put it back in it. So you start anew.
Vision quests were used by warriors to provide them with a direct link to the spiritual world, and to aid them in finding supernatural protection. The dance and the beating of the drum were, and still are, of great importance to the Plains Indians. By 1840, economic and social transformation of the Plains Indians from agricultural and sedentary societies to nomadic warrior hunters was complete. The military alliances among the tribes and their territories would not change over the next 50-year span on the plains. This period was called the Indian Wars. Ironically, at a time when much of the Western world was experiencing the Industrial Revolution, the Plains Indian horse culture had completed a grand experiment in producing a true warrior society. One that would nobly fight for its land and way of life. It was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning an era that saw the Alamo, the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War come and go. It was the 60 years of ongoing battles, fights, and raids that took place between the Great Plains nomadic horse warriors and settlers, traders, and the United States military. With as many as 20,000 casualties on each side, it made the Wild Wild West a dangerous and violent place. It is simply called the Indian Wars. The year was 1837. Martin Van Buren was in the White House. The famous Santa Fe Trail busily carried traders to New Mexico, and the fledgling Oregon Trail transported a few settlers and missionaries to Oregon country. Native American tribes from the east had been forced west into the newly designated Indian Territory, a territory already occupied by a flourishing Plains Indian culture. And Stephen Watts Kearney, the father of the U.S. Cavalry, wrote his Manual for the Exercise and Maneuvering of United States Dragoons. The Dragoons were the forerunner of America's celebrated frontier cavalry, soldiers on horseback. Organized in 1833, the Dragoons were the elite troopers of the frontier army. Their job was to police the western plains. Their weapons were the Prussian-style saber, known as Old Wristbreaker, the muzzle-loading 52-caliber rifle, and a 54-caliber pistol, both of which could blow a hole in a man the size of a melon. They also possessed formidable mountain howitzers. They dressed in flashy, striking uniforms of dark blue, with yellow piping, much like those the cavalry would later wear. In 1851, the official uniform was changed to blue with orange trim, no doubt meant to impress the colorfully painted Indian warriors of the plains. On the frontier, there were no buildings or structures to house these troops, so a series of forts was built, roughly paralleling the 95th meridian from Minnesota to Texas, a boundary separating Indian territory from white settlements. Typical of these military posts was Fort Scott. In 1842, companies A and C of the 1st and 2nd Dragoons were sent to what would become eastern Kansas. Assisted by only a handful of artisans and using local resources, their first task was to build the fort they were to occupy. The men completed the post in 1846 for a mere $32,000. Like most large military posts on the western frontier, Fort Scott was not enclosed by walls and resembled a village more than a traditional fort. A large parade ground formed the fort's nucleus, and at its center flew the American flag. The parade grounds were ringed by a complement of buildings, officers' quarters, barracks to house the cavalry and infantry, stables for the horses, and an assortment of specialty buildings, guardhouse, blacksmith shop, weapons and munition storage, bakery, and the quartermaster or supply house. A dragoon regiment was divided into 10 companies of about 75 officers and men in each unit. A captain, first lieutenant, second lieutenant, four sergeants, four corporals, two buglers, 50 privates, a blacksmith, and a farrier who treated the horses. During the construction of Fort Scott, the new Indian Territory was relatively quiet, free of major conflict between the native tribes and whites. However, in May of 1834, one of the Dragoons' first major duties was to escort a wagon train along the Santa Fe Trail to Mexican territory. Colonel Henry Dodge took 8 companies of the 1st Dragoons into Indian territory. In June, he recovered a white captive and conducted the first major conference with the heretofore nearly unknown Comanche and Kiowa tribes. Born in 1794, Kearney began his military career as a lieutenant in the War of 1812. A strong proponent of manifest destiny, he led the nation's move westward as an explorer and soldier. By the spring of 1845, he was ready to provide an impressive display of Dragoon power to the Plains tribes. Kearney gathered 5 companies of Dragoons, including a company from Fort Scott, and crossed the Great Plains. In May, Kearney marched his Dragoons from Fort Leavenworth in eastern Kansas, northwest to the Platte River, and then proceeded west to Fort Laramie. Along the way, he showed the flag to the native tribes. At a parley with the Pawnee, he requested they make peace with their traditional enemies, the Sioux. When they refused, the Dragoons fired their mountain howitzers, so impressing the Pawnee that the tribe remained peaceful for the next 4 years. It was the Sioux's turn next. At Fort Laramie, the Dragoons once more impressed the Indians with their firepower. The Sioux believed the Dragoons were a new and superior kind of white people, and they agreed to leave the immigrant traffic alone, if the immigrants behaved themselves. From Fort Laramie, Kearney and his men traveled the Oregon Trail as far west as present-day Wyoming's South Pass. It was the first time the U.S. military had crossed the Continental Divide. He then marched his troops south to Bent's Fort, where he parleyed with the Southern Cheyenne, a famous trading post in southeastern Colorado. Bent's Fort was founded in 1833 on the Arkansas River by William and Charles Bent and their partner, Soren St. Vrain. During its initial 16-year history, it was the single major white trading post on the Santa Fe Trail between Missouri and the Mexican settlements in present-day New Mexico. Colonel Kearney's trip to Bent's Fort in 1845 and again in 1846 so impressed Cheyenne chiefs with the power of the United States military that they feared for the future of their people. The Bent family, in a second Bent Fort, built 30 miles downstream in 1853, eventually played prominent roles in the Indian Wars that would soon follow. From Bent Fort, Kearney returned to Kansas along the Santa Fe Trail. His long 2,200-mile march in 99 days through the vast, semi-arid prairie proved that U.S. mounted troops could move rapidly and easily on the plains. Indeed, a year after Kearney's long march, he took his beloved Dragoons into the Mexican-American War, winning New Mexico and California for the U.S. Kearney briefly served as military governor of both territories. Then sadly, in 1848, he died from a bout of yellow fever contracted during the war. A year later, gold would be discovered in California, signaling the beginning of the Indian Wars. As for the Dragoon Regiment, in 1861, the Dragoon designations disappeared. The 1st and 2nd Dragoons became the 1st and 2nd Cavalry, and the Mounted Rifles became the 3rd Cavalry. All the units adopted the blue uniform with yellow trim, and the units became cavalry with yellow as their colors. Although the Dragoons resisted the new designation and the change to their uniforms, as the old uniforms wore out, they finally accepted their new role as cavalry. The Mexican-American War was a turning point for the U.S. military. For the first time since George Washington's winter at Valley Forge, the United States government created a large-scale professional army. After the Mexican-American War, America was a continental nation extending from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And the land along the Pacific coast is where Americans wanted to go. To the gold fields near San Francisco and the fertile farming valleys in Oregon. In the massive push to the Pacific coast, miners and settlers would have to traverse Indian country along the many overland trails. 50,000 immigrants traveled the Oregon Trail in 1850 alone. With over 200,000 Indians on the plains, Washington believed it had a duty to protect its traveling citizens. As a result, Congress authorized the War Department to construct a string of forts and outposts along the overland trails. By 1854, it had built over 50 garrisons. However, typical of Washington's approach to the Indian Wars, it sorely undermanned them with a mere 7,800 soldiers. The jewel of the northern system of forts was not built, but acquired. It was Fort Laramie in eastern Wyoming. Fort Laramie had started out as a trading post for trappers and Indians. In 1849, the Army's Adjutant General, Roger Jones, directed that a post be established at or near Fort Laramie. Rather than build a new fort, the Army purchased the trading post from Bruce Husband, agent of the American Fur Company, for $4,000. Immediately, the Army began refitting the old trading post as an Army post. By winter, officers' and soldiers' quarters, a bakery, and stables had been completed, and Fort Laramie began its 40-year role as a command post deep in the heart of Indian Territory. Fort Laramie quickly became the most famous, and some even say the most infamous post on the western frontier. For the over 350,000 travelers on the Oregon and Mormon trails, it was the lone beacon of civilization between East and West. Since its founding as a trading post in 1834, the list of those who entered the storied fort read like a who's who of the Old West. Famous trappers and mountain men: James Beckwith, Thomas Fitzpatrick, Jim Bridger, Kit Carson, and the ill-fated Donner Party, whose members would later eat each other, passed through in 1846. Brigham Young leading his Mormons to Utah. Top military commanders: William Tecumseh Sherman, Philip Sheridan, George Crook, and William Harney. Many of the famous chiefs of the Northern Plains spent time at the fort as well, along with a cast of colorful Western characters: Buffalo Bill Cody, Wild Bill Hickok, Calamity Jane, and Wyatt Earp. Less famous, though perhaps more important, were the troopers who manned the fort on a daily basis. Over its active 40-year history, units from nearly every cavalry and infantry regiment that fought in the Indian Wars served at the fort. But in 1849, it was the mounted riflemen and infantry soldiers who rode out from Fort Laramie to maintain the Oregon Trail. Patrols also escorted travelers, providing protection against the oftentimes curious Native Americans, who at this time had rarely, if ever, seen a white man. The mounted riflemen, like the dragoons, was a short-lived regiment, lasting a mere 15 years. They rode horses, dismounted, and then fought from the ground with their rifles. These unique riflemen served at Fort Laramie until the Civil War, when the regiment was redesignated the 3rd Cavalry. The simplest way for the men of these companies to do their mandated job of policing the trails in the 1850s was not through their weapons, but through the peace pipe, creating an agreement or a treaty that allowed the immigrants to pass peacefully through Indian Territory. Peace treaties had been the primary tool for negotiating with native tribes since the Dutch acquired Manhattan in 1624. They were in effect giant parties where Indian chiefs and representatives of the U.S. government met to hammer out, in the short term, who who would get what land, and how the parties would behave towards each other. The key figure in what would be called the Laramie Treaty was legendary mountain man Thomas Fitzpatrick, known among the Indians as Broken Hand. The Plains tribes knew and trusted Fitzpatrick, and the old mountain man knew that if something weren't done, soon the Indians would rise up against the ever-growing number of travelers on the Oregon Trail. Consequently, in 1849, Fitzpatrick sent word to Washington, requesting that a peace conference be called at Fort Laramie. Early in 1851, Congress appropriated $100,000 for such a purpose. But would the tribes respond? Once the snows were off the plains in the spring of that year, Fitzpatrick sent out trappers, mountain men, and some Fort Indians to invite all the Plains tribes to a peace conference. Everyone waited throughout the summer. Then in September, clouds of dust obscured the horizon. Fitzpatrick and the government representatives were awed by the arrival of more than 10,000 Indians from the northern plains, including such hereditary enemies as the Cheyenne and Shoshone, Sioux and Crow. The Fort Laramie Council was the largest of its kind ever seen on the plains. Such a huge number of warriors was clearly a threat to the three companies, a mere 180 troops stationed at Fort Laramie. In a clever move, Fort Laramie's commander, Captain William Scott Ketchum of the 6th Infantry, suggested that the council be moved 30 miles downstream to a better grazing area for the thousands of horses. And so it took place at the confluence of Horse Creek and the Platte River, just east of the current Wyoming-Nebraska state line. For nearly 2 weeks, the various tribes put on amazing displays of warrior prowess on horseback. The Americans passed out gifts. Leaders on both sides stood to deliver great speeches. By the end of the proceedings, a pipe, the traditional sign of a peace ceremony, was smoked and the treaty was signed. It was a remarkable accomplishment, allowing the U.S. government to construct a series of forts along the Oregon Trail. The Indians would not attack the wagon trains, and the immigrants would not settle in Indian territory. The military was allowed to patrol the trails, providing some semblance of law and order, and both sides agreed to punish their own lawbreakers. For 3 years, peace among whites and Indians reigned on the northern plains. Then in August 1854, an impetuous young officer, Lieutenant John Grattan, took a patrol of 29 men from Fort Laramie to arrest a Sioux Indian named High Forehead, who had stolen and butchered a Mormon's cow. The Sioux would not turn over the guilty party to the soldiers, and after a brief parley, the soldiers unexpectedly opened fire on the camp, killing its chief. The Sioux camp retaliated, massacring every member of Grattan's patrol. In that moment, the Indian Wars unofficially began. For the next 35 years, Fort Laramie played a prominent role in the conflict between the U.S. military and the Indian tribes of the Northern Plains. It became a staging ground for strikes against Indian encampments and was the site of another peace conference in 1868. From 1860 to 1861, Pony Express couriers rode through the fort. During the Civil War, volunteer regiments replaced some of the professional soldiers. Finally, in 1890, the fort closed for good. While Fort Laramie dominated the Northern Plains in 1854, to the south, other settlers and traders were traveling another famous road, the Santa Fe Trail, requiring the building of even more forts. While the northern tribes had fewer encounters with whites before the 1850s, the southern Indians, Kiowa, Comanche, Navajo, and Apache, had a long, violent history of conflict with Europeans. The Comanche, Apache, and Navajo had repeatedly defeated the Spanish, who were ill-prepared to rule the harsh southern plains. Later, they regularly raided Mexican and Texas settlements. Now that their lands had officially become part of the United States, the War Department was pressed to end the Indian threat to the Santa Fe Trail.
Yeah, Hispanics, you know, Mexicans from Santa Fe going east, they're hauling furs, stuff like that, stuff that you can't get back in St. Louis. And you got St. Louis merchants going west, they're hauling the nice shirts and the blankets, you know, bottles even, fancy stuff that you can't get in Santa Fe. They don't have no manufacturing there yet.
Once again, the Army employed the strategy of building forts and outposts to handle the increasing number of raids. One of the most prominent forts along the Santa Fe Trail, Fort Larned, was significant for the role it was to play as a post, a refuge, a supply point, and a distribution center for Indian annuities. Annuities, which were promised in peace treaties to the various tribes, were a kind of bribe to keep the peace. They typically consisted of flour, coffee, sugar, and trade goods, such as cloth, beads, and even arms and ammunition. Also supplied were agricultural implements, which were used to teach the Plains Indians farming and to discourage their nomadic lifestyle. However, the annuity plan created its own problems. All at once, hundreds of heavily armed Native American warriors descended on the post to collect their goods, sometimes dressed in their finest regalia, complete with painted faces and long war headdresses of eagle feathers. And the soldiers knew if the Indians went away unhappy, their anger might erupt into raids and even warfare. At times, the goods and food were of shoddy quality, or even worse, hadn't arrived at all. At these moments, tension ran high for the soldiers. In fact, in 1860, Fort Larned was known as Camp Alert because the danger of Indian attacks kept the soldiers on a knife edge. When word of a raid reached Fort Larned, the commander's response was to send out a patrol. A small patrol usually consisted of 10 to 20 privates and was led by a lieutenant and a sergeant. Each trooper was a self-contained unit.
The cavalry would have been equipped essentially like this, with a McClellan saddle. The bag here is called a nose bag. You have a little grain for maybe a day or two. We have a picket pin and a rope so we can stake him out at night. If that doesn't work, the ground is too hard, we have chains and hobbles. Inside of the bag we have a shelter half. My partner has the other half of the shelter, a blanket, perhaps change of clothes. Saddlebags would contain some bacon, hardtack, maybe some sardines. If I didn't spend all of my money, I'd maybe buy a couple of cans of sardines. I have a poncho. The carbine is a Springfield Model 4570. We also carried a Colt, which was a Model 1873 Colt 45, the Army Colt. And horses were typically maybe a little bit larger than this, but not any smaller.
Enthusiastic troopers often carried personal weapons such as extra pistols and knives when on patrol. Because the Indians roamed freely across the vast prairie, the Army had difficulty finding raiding parties. They relied on mountain men and trappers who were skilled trackers as scouts. These intrepid men had learned the Indians' habits and customs and often knew the area as well as they did. Wearing uniforms marked by red stripes, infantry soldiers did not carry swords but had bayonets. Their standard rifles, usually a .58 caliber muzzle-loading musket, were longer ranged than the cavalry's arms and laid down a better field of killing fire. Then in 1861, everything changed. The Civil War erupted, and the military, long neglected, took center stage. Everything military was overhauled. Training, weapons, leadership, and strategies all were vastly improved. At first, the Western garrison suffered. Volunteer units replaced most of Fort Larned's professional soldiers. But when Indian raids threatened critical supplies carried along the Santa Fe Trail, the Union sent two companies of cavalry to Fort Larned, and the trail once more became quiet until 1864, when a much-anticipated Indian uprising swept the prairie. Trade along the trail was paralyzed that summer and fall. As a result, larger, more punitive expeditions were sent out from Fort Larned and Fort Lyon. The U.S. military was about to begin a new phase of Indian fighting on the plains. Different tactics, as perfected by Kit Carson during the Army's campaign against the Navajo, would be used. It was also a time when forts, such as Larned, transitioned from havens for travelers to battle stations and supply centers for the new extended field campaigns. Born in 1809, Christopher Kit Carson, known as rope thrower to the Indians, became one of America's greatest frontier heroes in the mold of George Rogers Clark, Daniel Boone, and Davy Crockett. At the age of 16, he left home and started trapping, eventually becoming a legendary mountain man. His explorations led him the length of the Rocky Mountains into California. It was a time when few men survived the rugged travel through the mountains and deserts of the West. However, Carson had learned the ways of the Indians. By the time he was 40, his exploits were the tales told in salons of eastern cities. An unusual man along the rough and tumble community of mountain men, Carson, according to fellow trappers, was clean as a hound's tooth, and a man whose word was as sure as the sun coming up. He would soon become one of the pivotal commanders in the Indian Wars. The Navajo were a warrior culture that occupied the canyon lands of present-day New Mexico and Arizona. They had become a horse society before the famous nomadic tribes exploded onto the plains. After the Mexican-American War, the Navajo were in constant conflict with the United States military. In 1860, the Navajo chiefs Manuelito and Barboncito gathered 1,000 warriors and attacked Fort Defiance. The fighting was hand-to-hand, and the Navajo very nearly succeeded in capturing it. But when the dust settled, the army decided that it had to make an example of the Navajo in order to teach the desert Indians that they could not attack American soldiers. All-out war fell upon the tribe. For a year, U.S. Army Colonel Edward Canby chased after the elusive Navajo, but could not capture them. When the Civil War broke out a year later, the Navajo were temporarily forgotten. But in 1862, Union Brigadier General James Carleton led a force of men from California to fight Confederate troops. But by the time he arrived, the rebels were already retreating. Carleton turned his attention to the Navajo, determined to subdue them, completing what the Army couldn't do in the years before the Civil War. Carleton sought the help of Kit Carson, a longtime friend of the Navajo. Carson had been appointed a colonel in the 1st New Mexico Infantry in September 1861. Carson understood the Navajo. He had wintered with them, fought with them, and hunted with them. When Manuelito and others spurned his offers of peace, he knew the only way to victory was to destroy their farms and villages. No more peace treaties, no more retaliatory patrols. Instead, search them out and destroy them. So Carson, the one-time ally of the Navajo, began his scorched earth policy, destroying their fields, their crops, their livestock, and orchards. Within only a few months, the Navajo, starving and dressed in rags, surrendered and were sent to Bosque Redondo Reservation on the Pecos River, far from their homeland. After the Civil War, the Fetterman Massacre in northern Wyoming would turn public opinion against the Native Americans on the plains. In 1866, a war party of Sioux, led by High Backbone, lured a cavalry patrol of 80 men out of Fort Phil Kearny. The patrol, commanded by Captain William J. Fetterman, was ambushed, and all his men, including himself, were killed. Scalping and mutilation followed. Shocked and outraged, Americans demanded something be done. From the United States government point of view, the Plains Indians could no longer be allowed to live their nomadic lifestyle. For the whites, one disturbing facet of the Indian Wars was the Indian tactic of random raiding and killing. Rather than attacking the whites who had actually injured them, they took out their anger by raiding any available homesteads, wagon trains, or military patrols. Innocent settlers and travelers were terrified by the threat of their families being tortured and mutilated. A new approach was needed. The old military tactic of punishing the actual perpetrators of raids would never end the problem, since the guilty raiders could seldom be located. They needed to eliminate the threat at the source. Find the Indian villages and destroy them. Capture or kill their ponies and exterminate their primary food sources. This was what Kit Carson had so successfully done with the Navajo in the mid-1860s. Two hardened Civil War veterans were put in charge of the operation and further developed a total war strategy of eliminating the Indian problem once and for all. These two veterans were General Philip Sheridan and General William Tecumseh Sherman. William Tecumseh Sherman was one of the most celebrated generals of the Civil War and a man of military vision. In 1864, he was the first to apply total war to the rebellious southern states as Carson had once done a year earlier. Born in Lancaster, Ohio in 1820, he graduated from West Point, sixth in his class. Like many Union generals, Sherman had participated in the Mexican-American War, then rose to his highest distinction fighting the Confederates. Born in Albany, New York in 1831, Sheridan also grew up in Ohio. He attended West Point and graduated near the bottom of his class in 1853. Sheridan rose from obscurity to lead the Union's cavalry by war's end. His campaign in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia smashed the South's most important agricultural region and helped to end the Civil War. Sherman brought his strategy of total war to the Plains, and Sheridan refined it. Their shared philosophy of fighting Indians, summed up by Sherman, was simple. All Indians who are not on reservations are hostile and will remain so until killed off. Successfully implementing search and destroy required that the Army execute extensive campaigns with large military forces operating away from forts for weeks, even months. On July 1st, 1867, soldiers arrived here at Fort Davis, Texas. But they were not soldiers of the usual sort. They were black, and members of a new regiment, one of several whose men would soon become known as the Buffalo Soldiers. In 1866, the Army increased the number of cavalry regiments from 6 to 10, including two black units, the 9th and 10th. Called Buffalo Soldiers by the Indians because of the dark coats they wore and their short, curly hair, the black troopers epitomized America's new professional army, made up of battle-hardened veterans of the Civil War. Many of these men served on the western frontier until the Indian Wars ended in 1890. Fort Davis had been abandoned since 1861, and now companies C, F, H, and I of the 9th U.S. Cavalry under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Wesley Merritt returned. In addition to rebuilding the fort, the troopers escorted mail and stagecoaches, constructed roads, patrolled the Mexican border, and battled the Apache and Comanche. The 9th fought mostly in the Southwest until 1881. Later, units went to Kansas and Washington State. The 10th served with General Sheridan and were commanded by Colonel Benjamin Grierson, who had the 10th from 1866 to 1890 in the southern plains of Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Disciplined and tough, the 9th and 10th fought in 127 confirmed battles with Indians, on average inflicting 4.6 casualties per skirmish. Units from both regiments served in the Spanish-American War, the Philippine Insurrection, and Pershing's 1916 punitive raid into Mexico. At the outset of World War II, the 9th and 10th Cavalry were disbanded and their units absorbed into the Army. With the tragedy at Wounded Knee in 1890, the need for the cavalry on the plains vanished. The once important forts were abandoned. The era of the Wild, Wild West was over. What remained was a 40-year chapter in U.S. military history. It was a history that saw the cavalry grow from one semi-professional regiment of troopers, showing the flag to the Native Americans, to 10 regiments of highly disciplined soldiers. Their weapons changed even more dramatically from the slow-loading ball-and-powder muskets and pistols to breech-loading metal cartridge carbines and repeating pistols. Added to their arsenal were lightweight portable cannons and Gatling guns. The composition of the cavalry's officer corps changed as well. During the final 20 years, many of the officers won their spurs in the Civil War and then went on to fight Indians. What didn't change was that the core of the rank-and-file soldiers continued to be comprised of immigrants, mainly from Ireland and Germany, with the Irish making up more than 20% of recruits and Germans 12%. Many of these men had been soldiers in their homelands and quickly adapted to American army life, often becoming non-commissioned officers. In the 40 years from 1850 to 1890, over 70,000 men fought in more than 1,450 battles, inflicting an estimated 15,000 casualties on the Indians. During the same time, the number of troopers and civilians killed and wounded was around 12,000. Incredibly, more than 100 posts had been built on the plains during the Indian Wars. Even though the Indian Wars are long over, the tales of battles and individual valor will be told again and again in books, on the silver screen, and on television. The cavalry would once again arrive in the nick of time to save the day. Outposts such as Laramie, Larned, Davis, brave men, Kearney, Crook, Carson, bold and daring to the point of recklessness, fighters like Custer and Fetterman, and visionary militarists like Sheridan and Sherman will live on forever. No other group fulfilled the romantic vision of the United States military like the U.S. Cavalry. It was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning an era that saw the Alamo, the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War come and go. It was the 60 years of ongoing battles, fights, and raids that took place between the Great Plains nomadic horse warriors and settlers, traders, and the United States military. With as many as 20,000 casualties on each side, it made the Wild Wild West a dangerous and violent place. It is simply called the Indian Wars. In the battle for the North American continent, between the native peoples and the Euro-Americans, nothing has fueled the emotions and imagination more than the massacres on both sides during the Indian Wars in the second half of the 19th century. However, these were only the final chapter in a bitter 250-year struggle. Prior to colonial settlement along the eastern seaboard, there were many Indian nations distributed throughout what would eventually become the United States of America. Three important groups controlled the region east of the Appalachian Mountains. First, the Iroquois League held the balance of power in eastern North America until the end of the 18th century. Next, the Powhatan Confederacy held power over the middle and south Atlantic coast, including present-day Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia. The largest group, the Algonquian-speaking tribes, lived both east and west of the Appalachian Mountains. They formed a less powerful group that dominated the Great Lakes region and part of the Mid-Atlantic area. Further to the south and west were the Alabama, Caddo, and Tunica. Many of these tribes initially helped the colonists to thrive in the harsh conditions of North America, often symbolized by the first Thanksgiving in 1621 at Plymouth, Massachusetts. After that, the relationship between the colonists and Indians soon turned confrontational. At first, these hostilities took the form of skirmishes along the frontier, but soon evolved into wars. The first was the Pequot War in 1637. Fought in Connecticut and Rhode Island, it established a pattern for subsequent Native American warfare. When the Pequot refused to give up Indians who had murdered a white trader, the Puritans retaliated by attacking the principal Pequot settlement. Whites burned the village and slaughtered over 500 of its inhabitants. The surviving Pequot were relentlessly pursued until killed or driven out of the area. 40 years later, this strategy was used again in King Philip's War, 1675 through 76, to keep New England colonists from being driven into the sea. King Philip was given the name by the Puritans to a Wampanoag chief, Metacom. Though the Wampanoag were generally peaceful, King Philip resented white intrusions into their territory. In 1675, he led his tribe against the colonies of Plymouth, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. The Indian raiding parties burned several New England towns, killed and captured hundreds of colonists, and almost succeeded in driving the Europeans out of New England completely. But colonial soldiers finally ended the threat by destroying the Indian villages and killing King Philip. The destructiveness of the war led to the idea that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Long before it was attributed to General Phil Sheridan, nearly 200 years later, perhaps 1,000 colonists lost their lives, and the percentage of loss as compared to the total population made Philip's War the most devastating in American history. Never again would the Native Americans come as close to kicking out the Europeans from North America. Far to the southwest, Spanish priests and settlers pushed into the desert occupied by the Navajo, Apache, and Pueblo. Conquering the Pueblo, the Spanish tried to enslave them and convert them to Christianity. This worked for the better part of the 17th century, until in 1680, a charismatic medicine man, Pope, led the Pueblos in revolt against their Spanish overlords. They slaughtered 400 missionaries and settlers and forced the remaining colonists and their families to flee south to Mexico. It was this rebellion that released the Spanish horse onto the plains. Horses that went on to make up the wild Mustang herds that formed the nucleus of the nomadic Plains Indian warrior horse culture. In 1689, the Spanish came back in force and put down the rebellion, retaking Santa Fe in 1692. But the genie had been released from the bottle. The nomadic warrior culture was already underway. Dramatized in James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, the French and Indian War saw the native tribes fight on both sides of the seven-year conflict between the French and the British. The Iroquois joined the British, and the Algonquin Indians fought on the side of the French. Indeed, the French relied heavily on their Indian allies, even adopting their guerrilla-style warfare. But Britain's greater numbers and superior military minds and strategies defeated France by 1763. The French ceded all of Canada and eastern Louisiana to Britain. Dismayed at losing their ancestral lands, several Native American nations, under the leadership of Ottawa Chief Pontiac, continued to fight. Pontiac's words show the determination of the Indians. "It is important for us, my brothers, that we exterminate from this land this nation which seeks to destroy us. When the English are defeated, we shall stop up the ways hither so that they may never come upon our lands again." In what became known as Pontiac's War, the Chippewa, Seneca, and Delaware, among others, launched attacks on British outposts, overrunning garrisons at Sandusky, Ohio, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Niles, Michigan, Fort Michilimackinac on the straits between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan. The ferocity and swiftness of the Indians' attacks nearly succeeded in forcing the British out of the territory west of the Appalachians. But the British sent reinforcements to their beleaguered garrisons at Fort Pitt and Fort Detroit. Meanwhile, the French refused aid to Pontiac. In 1766, the Indians finally agreed to peace. Pontiac's war was the greatest stand by Native Americans until the Plains Indians War 100 years later. During those 100 years, Native American nations east of the Mississippi River battled with American military forces but were never able to claim victory. For example, the Miami and Shawnee, under the war chief Little Turtle, tried to halt the onslaught of settlers streaming into the old Northwest Territory, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana. They were nearly successful. In October 1791, Little Turtle's forces attacked General Arthur St. Clair on the Ohio-Indiana border near present-day Fort Recovery. St. Clair lost more than 800 of his 1,400 men. It was the greatest defeat ever suffered by an American military force, more than tripling Custer's losses at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. However, at the Battle of the Fallen Timbers in 1794, General Mad Anthony Wayne's well-disciplined troops dealt the Indians a crushing defeat, forcing them to cede lands to the new United States government in the 1795 Treaty of Greenville. 15 years later, the celebrated Shawnee war chief Tecumseh and his brother, known as the Prophet, tried to organize a grand alliance of Indian nations throughout the Ohio River Valley to fight westward migration. But at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811, General William Henry Harrison led a group of militia who destroyed any chance of Tecumseh's Confederation succeeding. Impressed by Tecumseh's oratory, the part-white William Weatherford, known as Red Eagle, led his Creek warriors against Fort Mims on the Lower Alabama River in August 1813. The fort's small group of militia fought until all were killed, and the Creeks massacred all but about 36 out of the 500 settlers who had taken refuge in the fort. In 1814, General Andrew Jackson smashed Southern Indian resistance to white settlers at the Battle of the Horseshoe Bend in Alabama. 3 years later, he took on the Seminoles in the First Seminole War and chased them out of South Georgia and Northern Florida. But the Seminoles would rise up against white settlers twice more from 1835 to 1842 and 1855 to 1858. Both times, they were defeated by American military forces. One of the last skirmishes east of the Mississippi River was Black Hawk's War. A Sauk Indian leader, Black Hawk, opposed giving Indian lands to whites. For 4 months, in the spring and summer of 1832, he led his band in a fight against American militia until his followers were virtually wiped out at Bad Axe River. By the 1850s, the Indian nations east of the Mississippi River lost their final battles with the U.S. government. However, from the time of the Pueblo uprising to the middle of the 19th century, a new kind of native culture developed on the continent. For the first time, Americans were about to be confronted by a true warrior culture. These were the seven warrior Indian nations: the Navajo, Apache, the Kiowa, the Comanche, the Arapaho, the Cheyenne, and the Sioux, that had migrated into the country's interior. True warrior cultures have been rare during Earth's history. The greatest honor for the one that arose on the American Central Plains was to count coup or to touch an enemy. Those warriors who acquired this distinction were held in the highest regard. From the time of birth, young boys were steeped in this culture, and all boys, whether they became warriors, hunters, scouts, or shamans, learned the arts of war from an early age. In fact, the way of the warriors started before birth. From the moment a woman became pregnant, she prepared her child for survival by making amulets that would protect him. These amulets were often in the shape of a lizard or a turtle. As for the fathers, once their sons were born, they made small weapons for them to play with, and when the child could stand, he gave him a bow. Growing up, boys played games that tested their skill with weapons. One game, the hoop game, had young boys shooting arrows at a rolling hoop of wood. Once a boy was old enough, his father gave him a colt and instructed him on how to ride and care for it. Around puberty, advanced warrior training began. They ran and swam for endurance, threw lances and shot arrows for skill, learned the art of making weapons, finally learning to shoot arrows from any position, even while riding a horse. Often a young warrior was left alone on the prairie. There he learned to fend for himself, know every animal track, find water where there was none, learned how to spot an enemy's trail, know what they were carrying, where they were going. Once these skills of riding, using weapons, survival, and tracking were conquered, the young warrior had to master the art of war. He did this by accompanying older warriors on raids for horses, or perhaps even in battle. The kind of warfare he was learning would in today's language be called guerrilla warfare. It especially included the art of ambush. With his training over, the life of a warrior might look like this. In his teens, he would be given more responsibilities, such as protecting the horse herds, At age 15 or so, a promising warrior candidate might be invited to join a warrior society. At 17, he might steal a horse or take a scalp. By 19, he would undergo his first sun dance ceremony, and by his mid-20s, lead his first war party. At age 30, with his young blood days behind him, he would begin to withdraw from warrior status and give himself over to the hunt. The most frequent purpose of a raid was to get more horses. A raid was usually prompted by a dream that guided a warrior to action. For example, Sitting Bull used his dreams to foretell the defeat of Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. The leader of the raiding party was known as the Pipeholder and generally was well acquainted with the landmarks and watering holes of the enemy territory. Raiders were scrupulous about following their dreams to the letter. If something was not right, or if an omen proved bad, the raid would be called off. Kiowa raiders were known to turn back to the sound of an owl hooting because the owl was considered a bird of ill omen. The simple raiding party consisted of 4 to 20 warriors. War parties were much larger. They could number in the hundreds of warriors. Raiders would be away from camp anywhere from 2 weeks to several months. The typical raiding party traveled in single file with the pipe leader in front, the more experienced riders next, and the neophytes last. Often scouts would ride ahead to make certain the way was clear. Before an attack or ambush, the warriors prepared themselves for battle, donning headdresses and painting their faces. Their individualized attack strategy, a strategy that embodied the warrior ethos, worked well against fellow Indian nations, but failed them in their later conflicts with the United States military. While a war party approached the camp as a unit, once a battle commenced, any thought of cooperation flew away, and every warrior fought for individual honors. On these raids, a warrior would have a full complement of weapons. The weapon of choice for the Plains Indian warrior was the bow and arrow. They made 2 types of bows, a self-bow fashioned from a single piece of wood, and a composite bow manufactured from layers of wood, bone, or horn, glued and lashed together with sinew. Warriors also made composite recurve bows that were so powerful that they could send an arrow completely through a buffalo. Bowstrings were made from sinew or rawhide strips. Most bows were from 3 to 3.5 feet in length and took at least a month to make. Usually warriors carried 2 or more bows when raiding. Bows were only as good as the arrows they shot, and warriors took special pains to ensure their arrows would fly straight and true. They used wood, plentiful on the plains, including gooseberry, ash, birch, cane, dogwood, currant, osage orange, and willow. They measured on the average 25.5 inches in length. Each arrow bore the owner's distinctive marks. Arrowheads were the most intriguing part of the arrow. Most Indians in the Plains Wars did not use stone points. Instead, the Plains warrior used iron tips obtained from the whites in trade or raids. When a wagon train was captured or a farmstead raided, iron barrel bands were taken as prime loot because one band could yield up to 20 arrowheads. Quivers held the bows and arrows. Like all the Plains warrior's belongings, the quiver was usually decorated with beads, quills, and animal skins. However, the arsenal of the Plains warrior was not limited to bows and arrows. From an early age, warriors were taught to fight with a variety of weapons, including lances, knives, clubs, and hatchets. All of these weapons were usually highly decorated with eagle feathers, animal skins, or quills. The knife was the most versatile weapon a warrior had, and could be used in a variety of tasks, from hunting and food preparation to killing an enemy. The earliest knives of the Plains Indians came from stone and were exceedingly sharp, able to cut meat precisely or take a scalp. But they dulled quickly, and during the Indian Wars, metal blades soon surpassed flint knives. And of course, warriors carried a war club for close-in fighting. With the introduction of the horse, club handles increased in length so that a warrior could strike an enemy while mounted on his horse. Club heads were first made from stone or buffalo horn, but the more famous and readily identifiable hatchets and tomahawk pipes were made from iron. Nothing struck fear in the heart of a settler or a cavalryman more than an Indian warrior charging with a tomahawk raised. Finally, as early as the mid-17th century, Indians obtained muskets through trading or raiding. By the time the Plains Indian culture arose, rifles were part of every trading company's stock. And just prior to the Indian Wars, every Indian nation possessed firearms. Still, the warrior on horseback with his bow and arrows was the earth's most effective fighting machine at that time. After years of fighting each other, the Plains Indians were about to test their warrior skills against the advancing American frontier. By 1850, the Plains Indian nations had settled into relatively stable territories. The Oregon and Santa Fe trails were carrying tons of trade goods and tens of thousands of settlers and miners to the West Coast. The U.S. government's dragoons and mounted riflemen were building a series of forts along these travel routes. At that time, raids by the nomadic tribes on settlers moving west were few. Then in 1854, all hell broke loose when Lieutenant John Grattan and a patrol of 29 men from Fort Laramie went to a Lakota Sioux village to arrest a warrior accused of stealing a cow. The soldiers unexpectedly opened fire. The Sioux retaliated, massacring every member of Grattan's patrol. In an instant, the carefully crafted peace of the 1851 Laramie Treaty was shattered, and the plains were engulfed in war. The Sioux were the largest of the Indian nations extended across the plains. They were divided into three groups, Dakota, Nakota, and Lakota. The Lakota, or Teton Sioux, were by far the largest and most successful warriors. They were the truest of the warrior cultures. So it was ironic that the event, which had the greatest influence in shaping white sentiment against the Plains Indians, took place in Minnesota by the last group to adopt the horse, the Dakota or Santee Sioux. In fact, the Santee Sioux used horses much in the manner of the mounted rifle companies, dismounting from their horses to engage in battle. The Santee were a woodland group of Indians, which had been pushed west onto reservations along the Minnesota River. And what was to become known as the Minnesota Massacre, or the Sioux Uprising, more whites were killed than in any other Indian war conflict west of the Mississippi. It began on August 17, 1862, when four Sioux hunters attacked a white farm family near Acton, Minnesota, killing the father, mother, and a daughter. For the next month, the Sioux rampaged against settlers, farms, and towns, killing 644 whites and capturing nearly 300 men, women, and children. The Santee chief, Little Crow, now declared that the war had begun. Little Crow knew the Santee had little chance of winning. However, he told his warriors, "Little Crow is not a coward. He will die with you." Other Santee war chiefs, Mankato, Big Eagle, Shakopee, and Greybeard also declared for war. The time to reclaim their land had arrived, and for the next month, southwestern Minnesota was aflame with fighting.
All right, as the uprising developed, the Indians had attacked both the upper and the lower agency. Some of the survivors that escaped those attacks managed to reach Fort Ridgely and bring the commander there, Captain John Marsh, the word of what had happened. Marsh was suspicious that the reports were exaggerated, but felt nonetheless that it would be necessary for him to investigate. So he marched from Fort Ridgely with a force of 46 men and one interpreter. When he reached the Redwood Ferry across from the lower agency, his force was attacked by Indians concealed in the brush along both sides of the river. In the fight that followed, approximately half of Marsh's command were killed, including Marsh himself, who drowned in the river. The remainder of his force managed to return to Fort Ridgely.
In the course of the uprising, the Sioux mostly attacked undefended farms and small settlements. But in two instances, they attacked a large town and an army post.
Following the attack on Redwood Ferry, on Marsh's command at Redwood Ferry, the Indians could not agree as to whether they should attack Fort Ridgely or New Ulm. Little Crow was of the opinion that they needed to attack Fort Ridgely, but he was outvoted by the majority of the warriors who wanted to attack New Ulm, seeing that there was a lot of plunder to be had in that community, which was then about 1,000 people. So the majority of the Indians then moved toward New Ulm. A stiff fight ensued, in which the Indians were eventually repulsed by the determination of the defenders, supported by some local militia from the surrounding areas. The following day, the Little Crow was able to muster a strong force of warriors. They attacked Fort Ridgely and were repulsed. And New Ulm itself was attacked a second time several days later. And again, the defenders were successful in repelling the Indians.
By the beginning of September, the tide of battle had swung against the Sioux. The final engagement took place at Woodlake, Minnesota.
In late September, Colonel Sibley, who had been appointed military commander of the region by the governor of Minnesota, marched up the Minnesota River Valley with a force of approximately 1,600 men, composed mainly of volunteer regiments of Minnesota infantry that had been recalled from Civil War duty. On the 23rd of September, 1862, Sibley's force encountered Little Crow and his warriors, numbering perhaps as many as 1,000, in what has come to be known as the Battle of Wood Lake. The Indians were defeated.
After the defeat, Little Crow released his 269 women and children captives. Of the 2,000 warriors who surrendered, 393 were tried, and 303 condemned to death by hanging. However, President Lincoln investigated the trials and the causes of the uprising and approved death sentences for only 39 of the 303 convicted Indians. One was later reprieved. These remaining 38 warriors were hung at Mankato, Minnesota on December 26, 1862.
The uprising galvanized action throughout not just Minnesota, but throughout the region. Military action followed in 1863 and 1864, in which the survivors of Little Crow's army, if you want to think of it as that, Colonel Sibley and General Alfred Sully conducted campaigns pursuing the Indians out into Dakota Territory. In 1863, there were successful actions at Dead Buffalo Lake, Whitestone Hill, and Killdeer Mountain in 1864.
The consequences of the Minnesota massacre would be felt farther west on the plains for the next 28 years, especially in Colorado at Sand Creek. Sometime around 1740, the Cheyenne Nation migrated onto the plains along the Missouri River in South Dakota. While still living as traditional woodland Indians, they had been preyed upon for decades by other tribes and nearly driven to extinction. That changed with the Great Horse Dispersal at the beginning of the century. Practically overnight, the Cheyenne became skilled horsemen. Now capable of handling their former enemies, the Sioux and Crow, they became formidable fighters. At the same time, they also became expert buffalo hunters. Adopting the Sioux teepee for living, the Cheyenne warrior hunter bands could now take their families with them when they needed to follow the buffalo. On the plains, the Cheyenne prospered and their numbers grew dramatically. Militarily, their strength also grew, first through an alliance with the Arapaho and later the Sioux. Together, they drove the Kiowa and the Crow out of the prized Black Hills of South Dakota. 75 years of nomadic life had turned the Cheyenne into a full-fledged warrior culture. In the early 19th century, the Cheyenne had become so successful, they were raiding the large Comanche horse herds south of the Arkansas River. During these raids, many of the Cheyenne fell in love with the region of Kansas and Colorado north of the Arkansas River. It was resplendent with tall grass prairie and buffalo. By 1825, over half of the Cheyenne Nation, joined by many Arapaho, had migrated into this buffalo-rich region permanently. The move was motivated by economics. The Cheyenne chief, Yellow Wolf, met with the Bent brothers, and together they created a highly lucrative trading partnership centered at Bent's Fort on the Arkansas River. For a time, all seemed well between the Southern Cheyenne and whites. So much so that White Antelope and A Light on the Cloud, two Cheyenne chiefs, met with President Fillmore in 1851 in Washington, D.C., as did another delegation, which included Cheyenne chiefs War Bonnet, Stand in the Water, and Lean Bear, who met with Abraham Lincoln during the height of the Civil War in March 1863. Oddly, soon after this second peace trip, widespread hostilities broke out among many Cheyenne and whites, while other Cheyenne were attempting to change and adopt the lifestyles of the whites. This paradox and confusion would lead to tragedy. After the Minnesota Massacre, where more than 600 settlers were slaughtered by the Santee Sioux in 1862, fear of the Indians on the plains ran high among whites. In Colorado, this fear was brought home on June 11, 1864.
June 9th, 10th, and 11th, there were Indian raids all around this area right here. On June 11th, at this site, the Hungate family was killed. Nathan Ward Hungate, 29 years old, Ellen, 25, and their two daughters, Laura and Florence. Laura not yet 3 and Florence not yet 5 months. They were killed here. Their bodies were then brought into Denver and displayed. They had been mutilated. Nathan was found about a mile or a mile and a half south of here along the creek, Running Creek, Box Elder Creek. These raids were done by Cheyenne, Kiowa, and Arapaho. Later, Arapaho were identified as the perpetrators of this killing, but it was always identified as a small number, maybe 4. But the evidence of the fire at the house in modern archaeology and the weapons found, there's evidence of 8 weapons that were used in a long siege here as they were burned out, shows that it had to be a large party, at least 20. Maybe 60, and that they took the time to kill this family. Why did they do that? Probably because Nathan shot one of the Indians who was stealing stock, as there had been stock stolen all around this area on June 9th and 10th. And all of the reports of these Indians is that they were Arapaho, Kiowa, and Cheyenne. They were all armed, and there was no violence at all. The only violence was here. Violence occurs later in August on the Overland Trail, not far from Colorado and Nebraska, and 53 settlers are killed there. And that, along with the murder of the Hungate family, is what fueled the military expedition and the 3rd Volunteer Colorado Cavalry and Colonel John Chivington to attack Chief Black Kettle Cheyenne Village at Sand Creek on November 29, 1864.
A month earlier, near Fort Larned, Kansas, the Cheyenne chief Lean Bear, just back from his meeting with Lincoln, was gunned down by troopers as he approached, showing the peace medal given to him by the president. Using this attack as an excuse, the Cheyenne dog soldiers made settlers in Kansas and eastern Colorado pay a heavy price. Indeed, this attack added fuel to the raid the Cheyenne had already begun at the same time. In June 1864, Colorado Territorial Governor John Evans issued a proclamation directing friendly Indians to appear at the various U.S. government forts. 2 months later, the great Cheyenne chief Black Kettle requested a meeting with the commander of Fort Lyon, Major Edward Wynkoop. Wynkoop was highly impressed with Black Kettle. He later wrote, "The chief sat, dignified, immovable, with a slight smile on his face. A bond of mutual trust was formed between the two men. As a result, Black Kettle, White Antelope, and Bull Bear, one of the leaders of the dog soldiers, traveled to Denver to meet with Governor Evans and Colonel John M. Chivington for a council held at Camp Weld. Chivington, a former minister, was the military commander in Colorado Territory and nominal head of the 3rd Colorado Regiment, formed exclusively to hunt down Indians. At the meeting, Black Kettle said, "All we ask is that we may have peace with the whites. You are our father. We've been traveling through a cloud. The sky has been dark ever since the war began." In return, Evans accused the Cheyenne of initiating hostilities and said, "The time when you can make war best is in the summertime. When I can make war best is in the winter. You, so far, have had the advantage. My time is just coming." At the end of the conference, Chivington stated, "My rule of fighting white men or Indians is to fight them until they lay down their arms and submit to military authority. They are nearer Major Wynkoop than anyone else, and they can go to him when they get ready to do that." Ironically, both sides wanted peace, and yet the conference ended without any firm commitment to peace from either side. Indian historian D. Brown wrote that Black Kettle took Chivington's remarks to mean that Black Kettle's people would be safe if he brought them to Fort Lyon on the Arkansas River. However, other historians dispute this claim, pointing out that when the Indians went back to Fort Lyon, they stopped at the cattle ranch owned by John Prowers and told him they could not make any treaty of peace with them, meaning Evans and Chivington. On November 9, 1864, Black Kettle and the Cheyenne began arriving at Fort Lyon. By this time, Wynkoop had been relieved of his command for being too soft on Indians, such as giving them food and supplies against orders. The new commander, Major Scott Anthony, directed Black Kettle and his band to camp 40 miles to the northeast on the Big Sandy, also known as Sand Creek. Meanwhile, Chivington had other plans.
Colonel Chivington, who had been at the Camp Weld Council in Denver in September 64, learned at that meeting that the Indians that he had been hunting for and hoping to kill for several years were probably camped at the Fort Lyon area or on the Big Sandy Creek nearby. In mid-November, he left Denver with his troops headed downriver down the Arkansas to Fort Lyon, which he reached on the night of November 28th.
On November 28th, now in command of 700 troops armed with short-barreled carbines and pistols, and with four 12-pound mountain howitzers, Shivington ordered his cavalry to march to Black Kettle's encampment.
There were probably 115, 120 teepees here, with maybe 500 men, women, and children. Shivington approached from the south, approached the village. Some of the Indians actually went out to meet him. As a matter of fact, some of the first casualties of the fight here were two Colorado troopers who were shot down off of their horses. There was no mass charge through this village. Shivington had dismounted his men, and they actually walked through the village, allowing the Indians to escape up creek and a little bit more to the north, northwest up the creek. The soldiers walked through the village. When they got to the far end, they saw the Indians fleeing, and it was at that time that many of the officers lost control of their men. And the men, almost on an individual basis, started going after the fleeing Indians. They chased them up creek for several miles. As they ran, the Indians dug in at points all along the creek bed, dug themselves homemade rifle pits to make little defensive positions. The soldiers chased them throughout the rest of the day on the 29th. The battle lasted from dawn up until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was quite a long, drawn-out affair. There were quite a few casualties, more than we would think of. The soldiers took 76 casualties. That was about 25 killed and 51 wounded, which may not sound like a lot, but in the context of the Indian Wars, that was a heck of a fight. That was put Sand Creek up at the top of all the fights in the Indian Wars as per casualties. As for the Indians, that was pretty devastating to them also. They lost probably upwards of 150 killed. The things that distinguished Sand Creek here was afterwards, after the battle, the atrocities. Some of the men, again, lost control. They no doubt were angry. They had known what had happened through the rest of the summer with the Indian raiding, the massacre of the Hungate family in June outside of Denver. And the soldiers were taking vengeance. They had scalped and mutilated a lot of the Cheyenne bodies after the fight. I no doubt they saw this as a just vengeance and a great victory. For the Cheyennes, of course, they view the event as a massacre.
Miraculously, Black Kettle survived, even while returning to save his wounded wife. However, Shivington's massacre at Sand Creek elevated the Cheyenne military societies, particularly the Dog Soldiers, into power. Americans back east were horrified by the Sand Creek massacre. Lincoln removed Governor Evans, and 2 months after Sand Creek, Shivington was out of the service. Black Kettle's peace attempts had failed, and now the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Sioux, enraged by Sand Creek, chose to make war to the knife. The massacres in Minnesota and Sand Creek inflamed passions on both sides. And for the next 26 years, there'd be a battle to the death for the Great Plains.
Thank you. It was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning an era that saw the Alamo, the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War come and go. It was the 60 years of ongoing battles, fights, and raids that took place between the Great Plains nomadic horse warriors and settlers, traders, and the United States military. With as many as 20,000 casualties on each side, it made the Wild Wild West a dangerous and violent place. It is simply called the Indian Wars. By the middle of the 19th century, the stage was set for the longest war in U.S. history. Between the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, the United States cavalry would wage an all-out battle with the nomadic Plains Indians, who had come to flourish on what was once called the Great American Desert. The battle for the Plains divided into two fronts, the North and the South. In the North were the Sioux, the Cheyenne, and the Arapaho. They occupied an area that extended north from the Arkansas River to the Canadian border. The first chapter in this battle began in 1845 when Colonel Stephen Kearny took 250 men in five companies of the 1st Dragoons across the plains, showing the flag, hoping to demonstrate the United States military might and superiority. In 1851, the Laramie Peace Treaty between the northern tribes and the U.S. government established peace over the region. Immigrants and traders now traveled freely across the plains on the Oregon Trail. But peace was short-lived. In 1854, the Grattan Fight near Fort Laramie set off a war between the U.S. and Plains Indians that would last until 1890. Passions ran high on all sides. The massacre of white settlers by the Sioux in Minnesota and the massacre of Cheyenne women and children at Sand Creek, Colorado, inflamed whites and Indians alike and forced a long war that would determine once and for all who would control America's Great Plains. After the Civil War, the U.S. War Department revitalized the military on the plains by creating an additional four cavalry regiments for a total of 10, placing them under the command of the Union generals who had destroyed the South and won the Civil War. Men like William Tecumseh Sherman, who burned Atlanta and cut the Confederacy in half. Philip Sheridan, who destroyed the South's breadbasket, the Shenandoah Valley. And the reckless and daring cavalry leader, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. These military leaders eventually brought a war of total annihilation to the Plains Indians. As of March 1871, the Indian tribes were no longer viewed as nations open to negotiation, but the subjects of United States law. Many of the northern Indian bands didn't agree and were willing to engage in guerrilla warfare against what they considered to be their oppressors. Their leaders were the great chiefs of the Northern Plains. Facing the cavalry were Native Americans who had been tested by the constant warfare between the Plains Indians tribes. The Northern Indian tribes, the Sioux, Arapaho, and Cheyenne, were governed by chiefs, but they weren't like the chiefdoms that ruled some of the eastern Indian nations. That is, they weren't ruled or governed by a single powerful leader. Indeed, at any given time, each tribe had many chiefs. For example, the Cheyenne had a civil governing council of 44 chiefs, four from each of its 10 bands. In addition to the civil governing chiefs, there were also many war chiefs, warriors who had distinguished themselves in battle. While the war chiefs spoke for their warrior societies, they did not speak for the tribe as a whole. However, the U.S. government needed the participation of the War Society leaders to legitimize any peace agreement. Having no other term for these non-civil leaders, the whites usually called them chiefs as well. Many of the so-called chiefs associated with the battles of the Northern Plains were war leaders and spiritual leaders. Unlike the kings and queens of Europe, the position of chief was not hereditary, nor was it democratic. They were selected for their qualities of excellence in battle and wisdom in governing for the welfare of the band or tribe. Some of the best-known chiefs in the 36-year battle for the Northern Plains were the Sioux leader Red Cloud, whose tactics shut down the Bozeman Trail in 1867. Roman Nose, the charismatic leader of the fierce Cheyenne warriors. The Sioux war chief and spiritual leader, Sitting Bull, who led the fight to save the Black Hills. The Cheyenne leader, Dull Knife, who fought with Red Cloud to shut down the Bozeman Trail. In Minnesota, the Santee Sioux leader, Little Crow, took on the settlers and the army. And Crazy Horse, the oddball and brilliant Sioux war leader whose tactics turned back General Crook at the Rosebud fight, and a week later defeated Custer at the Little Bighorn. One of the best-known chiefs would have one phase of the battle for the Northern Plains named after him. It was the battle for the Bozeman Trail, often called Red Cloud's War. Curiously, the battle for the Northern Plains started at its southernmost reaches, at a lonely place along a minor tributary of the Arkansas River. At a bend on the Big Sandy on November 29, 1864, over 100 Cheyenne, mostly women and children, were massacred by a United States military force commanded by Indian-hating Colonel John Shivington. Led by Black Kettle, these Indians were moving towards accommodation with Washington's desire to place all nomadic Indians on reservations, where they would learn a sedentary lifestyle. Once the word of the Sand Creek Massacre spread, many bands of Cheyenne and Arapaho were horrified and enraged. Not only were they angry with Black Kettle's course of action, but they also sought revenge. In the dead of winter, a great war council convened at Cherry Creek, Kansas. Smoking the war pipe were Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho and many Sioux bands. It was the start of what would be called the Winter Offensive of 1865.
One of the most successful Indian campaigns ever occurred in February of 1865, shortly after the Sand Creek Massacre in November 1864. There were thousands of Indians that gathered in northeastern Colorado and western Kansas. They voted almost unanimously to go to war against the whites. There were Lakotas, there were Cheyenne, there were Arapaho. They moved in early January against the line of forts and stations along the South Platte River. The first place they hit was at Julesburg, and which was up in northeastern Colorado, right on the right near Fort Rankin. They swept into Julesburg and started burning the buildings. The nearby settlers and soldiers all fled into the Fort Rankin. The Indians had a little trick, though. They tried to decoy the soldiers out, and they almost succeeded. They did get some of the soldiers out of the fort. The soldiers chased them into the bluffs a bit, but an over-anxious warrior shot off his rifle a little too soon and alerted the soldiers to the trap. They ran back to the fort. There were about 14 or so killed, but the majority got back safely into the fort, and after that point they didn't come out anymore. The Indians who were in Julesburg destroyed or stole about $40,000 worth of property, and they also found in one box a number of strange-looking green papers that they scattered to the wind. Of course, the paper was money, and they didn't realize the value of it. The Indians also, along throughout the month of January, they attacked several stations. They attacked Wisconsin Ranch and Denison's and American Ranch, Godfrey's Ranch. The attack on American Ranch was successful. They had killed Mr. Morris and many of his employees, and they captured Susan Morris and her children. They tried to attack Godfrey's Ranch also, and Godfrey put up a little better defense. He and his wife, children, and employees held out behind their adobe walls and actually killed about 17 attacking Cheyenne and Lakota. The successful defense there earned Godfrey the name of Old Wicked, and his ranch there, the Indians later called Fort Wicked. The Indians were back, though, in early February. They had never left the area. They had been blocking off the supplies, the mails. Colorado was isolated. Nobody could get through, and in early February, they were still around. They attacked Julesburg again, burned down and destroyed the little bit that the people had built back in the month intervening between the two fights. They surrounded Fort Rankin again, and this time the soldiers didn't come out. They stayed put. The Indians had their say, and after about a month and a half of hanging around the South Platte Valley and doing what they wanted, the Indians finally moved off north and ended up in what is today Wyoming. If John Shivington had any satisfaction out of all this, if he wanted to drive the Indians out of Colorado Territory, well, he actually finally did so, but they left on their own accord, and they left taking their own sweet time about it.
The Cheyenne headed north with their allies, reaching the Powder River in northwestern Wyoming by spring. The nearly 1,000 warriors and their families were never seriously threatened by the army. However, it was only a matter of time before Washington responded to the Indian raids along the South Platte. Washington's response came that summer. Brigadier General Patrick E. Connor was in charge of a campaign that would push deep into Sioux territory. However, the campaign was largely a failure. But it did keep the Sioux and the Cheyenne from raiding along the South Platte Road in Colorado. At the same time, the Sioux and the Cheyenne felt that they had chased the soldiers out of the Powder River country and taught them a good lesson. Perhaps more importantly, one Sioux leader, Red Cloud, learned an important lesson fighting the whites. Massive charges against the new weapons of the soldiers could not succeed if the warriors were armed only with lances, bows and arrows, war clubs, and the old muzzle-loading rifles of the fur trapper days. Not far from this reconstructed Fort Phil Kearny in northern Wyoming, the U.S. military experienced its worst defeat in the Indian War to date. It was reconstructed because Indians under the leadership of Red Cloud and Ogallala Sioux burned down the original after its abandonment, along with other forts on the Bozeman Trail. The disaster occurred here at the site of this monument. In December of 1866, snow was on the Bighorns. It was a gloomy day, and woodcutters were gathering the necessary fuel for the fort's operations. Suddenly, the woodcutters came under attack by a small Sioux raiding party. When word of the attack reached the fort, its commander, Colonel Henry B. Carrington, sent Captain William J. Fetterman to protect the woodcutters and the wagons. Carrington ordered Fetterman not to pursue the raiding party, as this was a common ambush tactic used by the Indians. However, Fetterman ignored his orders and chased after the raiding party. He chased the party over this ridge into a trap. On what would become known as Massacre Hill, upwards of 1,000 Sioux and Cheyenne warriors rose up from hiding and attacked the patrol. Fetterman's command of 81 men was completely wiped out. Fetterman and another captain, Frederick H. Brown, reportedly shot each other simultaneously in the head at the end of the battle. The Indians had lost 63 warriors with nearly 100 wounded. Ironically, two civilians using repeating Henry rifles killed and wounded most of these Indians. The leader of the ambush, was a Minikanju Sioux, Chief High Backbone. The battle also launched the military career of the famous Sioux warrior Crazy Horse. When the battle was over, as Shivington's men had done to the dead Cheyenne at Sand Creek, the Sioux mutilated Fetterman and his men, scalping, hacking off limbs, and disemboweling the dead soldiers. A tough winter followed for the troops at Fort Phil Kearny, Fort C.F. Smith, Fort Reno, and Fort Laramie. The Indians, expecting the usual retaliation, dispersed. But when none materialized, they resumed raiding forts along the Bozeman Trail. Then on August 2, 1867, the Wagon Box Fight took place. This battle contained a tactical lesson for Red Cloud's army.
They removed the wagon boxes from the running gear, or the chassis if you prefer, of the wagons, and arranged these in an oval into which they herded the livestock at night to protect them from Indian depredations. On the morning of August 2nd, 1867, probably about 7 to 8 o'clock, the defenders at the wagon box corral and the woodcutters and their escorts at the various cutting areas around the corral, probably anywhere from a half a mile to a mile distant, were attacked by a large body of mainly Sioux warriors. In the fight that ensued for the next several hours, the defenders positioned inside the wagon box corral were able to very successfully repel three or possibly even four assaults by the Indian warriors. The advantage that the defenders brought to this particular fight was the Springfield Allen breech-loading rifle with which they had been recently issued. What the Springfield Allen breech-loader, the advantage of that is that the top of the breech is opened and a cartridge is inserted into the chamber. The breech closed, the weapon is cocked, and then fired. As opposed to the muzzle loading weapon, where the bullet and the powder have to be inserted into the barrel of the weapon, rammed home, and then the weapon is cocked and fired. So the breech loading weapon meant that the defenders had were able to put out a heavier volume of firepower than they would ordinarily have been able to do. And the Indians found this disconcerting and were unable to overcome it. A relief column arrived from the fort about 1 o'clock, 1:30 perhaps, and the Indians dispersed upon the arrival of the relief column. The Indian casualties ranged probably the 50 to 60 casualties is the most accurate. Army casualties, there were 3 killed and 2 wounded.
Washington now changed directions and called for a new peace conference to be held at Fort Laramie in the fall of 1867. Chief Red Cloud said he would not attend until the forts were abandoned along the Bozeman Trail. In a surprise move, they were. Red Cloud and his warriors burned the hated Fort Phil Kearny to the ground. Soon after, Red Cloud arrived at Fort Laramie in November of 1868 and signed one more peace treaty. So who was this Chief Red Cloud? Red Cloud was perhaps the most important Plains Indian leader in the 19th century. As a warrior chief, his tactics copied the Army's best strategies. He used decoys to draw cavalry patrols into ambushes. And like the cavalry, he established a supply depot so that his followers had a constant source of food, arms, and ammunition. enduring attacks, his warriors worked together instead of pursuing individual honors. What was remarkable about Red Cloud was that in his 50s, after using war to obtain autonomy for his people, he wisely switched to politics as the only hope for Sioux freedom, even as others such as Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were fighting the battle for the Black Hills. Using his prestige in the 1880s on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, he worked to obtain precious food and supplies for his people. Opposing the Ghost Dance movement, he understood that it would bring the army to the reservation, which resulted in the massacre at Wounded Knee. Red Cloud died in 1909, still fighting for the dignity and self-reliance of the Lakota. The peace negotiated during the Second Laramie Treaty would last briefly until the next chapters of the battle for the Northern Plains, the fight for the Black Hills, and the demise of the Cheyenne. While the Sioux leader Red Cloud chased the soldiers out of the Powder River area, another tribe, a tribe as old and fearsome as the Sioux, was entering its twilight on the plains. By the end of 1869, the proud and daring Cheyenne were in decline. After the 1865 winter offensive along the South Platte, many of the Cheyenne were homesick for their ancestral buffalo hunting grounds in eastern Colorado and western Kansas, lands that were in demand for settlement. In the spring of 1867, the Cheyenne leaders Tall Bull, White Horse, Graybeard, and Bull Bear, along with Roman Nose, were summoned to a meeting at Fort Larned, Kansas, by General Winfield Scott Hancock. Hancock warned them against war and told them that they must relocate. Uneasy with his terms, the Cheyenne returned to their camp. A week later, with 1,400 troops, including Custer's 7th Cavalry, Hancock advanced upon the Cheyenne village, wanting to speak with their war chiefs, especially Roman Nose. But frightened by so many soldiers, the warriors and their families fled. During their flight, some of the Cheyenne raided stagecoach stations, ranches, and railroad camps, bringing travel across western Kansas and eastern Colorado to a standstill. As a result, Hancock burned the lodges, equipment, and food the Indians had abandoned. In August 1867, Hancock was assigned to the Military District of New Orleans, and Washington ordered General William Tecumseh Sherman to seek peace. In the fall of 1867, the Kiowa, Comanche, Arapaho, Kiowa Apache, and Cheyenne gathered 60 miles south of Fort Larned at Medicine Lodge Creek. At first, Roman Nose refused to attend the meeting. However, the whites knew that a peace treaty without Roman Nose's signature was worthless. No Cheyenne warrior exhibited more physical perfection or personal power. His 6'4" presence and reputation of being impervious to bullets on the battlefield emboldened all his Indian warriors, pushing them into frenzied attacks. By 1867, his stature as a warrior was so great that he commanded the allegiance of several hundred Cheyenne warriors from all the Cheyenne societies. Finally, Roman Nose showed up at the Medicine Lodge conference site in October. When the moment of signing came, Roman Nose could not sign nor accept reservation life. Nearly 400 warriors headed north, having cast their lots with the Cheyenne's most famous warrior, Roman Nose, who would not surrender. He was determined to live or die in the Cheyenne's ancestral lands. During the spring and summer of 1868, Roman Nose led his men in raids against the whites. Eventually, Cheyenne chiefs Tall Bull and White Horse and their followers joined him. To find these raiders, the army created a special company of 50 rough frontiersmen known as Forsyth's Scouts. On September 17th, the scouts trailed the Indians to the Arickaree Fork of the Republican River. At this place called Beecher Island, a great battle took place.
The fight was a result of Indian raids that had been taking place in north-central Kansas throughout the summer of 1868, and a civilian force under Major Sandy Forsyth was organized and decided to trail the Indians. They went through western Kansas for a few weeks until they came on a big trail, which led them here to the Arickaree Fork of the Republican. And here they found about bit off a little bit more than they could chew. The scouts were on the north side of the creek when that morning of the 17th they discovered a few Indians trying to steal their horses. The few Indians turned out to be about 500, and Major Forsyth told the scouts, let's get ourselves across the river and onto this little sandy island that was in the middle of the Arickaree down in that area. They dug themselves into the sand, killed some of their horses, and very soon the Indians accommodated them by charging down on them. The Indians would have come out from up creek a little farther in this area here. There was a canyon behind where they massed some of their charges in that first day. There were three or four major charges. There were some of them led by Pawnee Killer, led some of the Lakotas. Tall Bull was here of the Cheyenne Dog Soldiers, Bull Bear. They made several charges down the Arickaree against the dug-in scouts on what would become known as Beecher Island. That was for Lieutenant Frederick Beecher, who was killed here. Throughout the day, about the only things that was saving the scouts was their Spencer repeating rifles. Finally, at the end of the day, Roman Nose showed up, who was one of the famous warriors, leaders of the Elkhorn Scraper Society. And they said, Roman Nose, where have you been? Well, Roman Nose has, throughout this day, knew of the fighting, but his medicine was broken. Roman Nose had the day before eaten in a Sioux camp, and he had been given fried bread with an iron utensil, which he couldn't do. He was only supposed to eat with wood, and he knew that was going to break his medicine. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, Roman Nose decided he's going to have to fight, even though he knew he would be killed. Roman Nose gathered up one of the final charges of the day. Probably 50 yards or so short of the island, the Spencers rang out again. Roman Nose went down, hit several times. The scouts had survived the day. The warriors had found Roman Nose and taken him back to give him proper burial.
With Roman Nose dead, most of the Cheyenne now headed south to be with Black Kettle. But within a year, a few Dog Soldiers, under the leadership of Tall Bull, came north again. In the spring of 1869, they ravaged the Saline and Solomon Valleys in north-central Kansas, murdering settlers and capturing women and children. This time, the army pursued them relentlessly, attacking the Cheyenne wherever they could catch them and forcing them to stay constantly on the run. On July 11, 1869, Major Eugene Carr and 250 soldiers caught up with the elusive Cheyenne here at Summit Springs, south of Sterling, Colorado.
On Sunday, July 11, 1869, Carr with the 5th Cavalry, Buffalo Bill Cody, the North Brothers, caught up with Cheyenne Chief Talbot of the Dog Soldier Society right here at Summit Springs, and attacked them from the northeast up here at about 2:30 in the afternoon, after chasing them for several weeks from Kansas into here, and charged down in here. The village had 84 lodges that spread out about a mile up this way and a half a mile that way, and that would be about 200 warriors and maybe 300 women and children and older men. And so most of those were able to escape down in this direction to the south and southwest. and got away. There was a sharp fight up here right at the beginning, but most of the warriors that were the victims of the Summit Springs fight ended up right over here in the ravines right here, where there would be a sharp fight and where Talbot eventually is killed along with about 20, 25 warriors. Now, Talbot's own teepee was about where we're standing right here. It was in front of this part right here. And in the teepee were two women that had been captured in Kansas in earlier raids, and why this military expedition was happening to try to rescue them. One of them was Maria Weichel, who was shot in the back and found in Talbot's teepee. The other woman apparently maybe got out of the teepee or what, but she was found with her skull crushed, about 100 paces up this way, and her name was Susanna Alderdice. And these were the two victims that they were trying to rescue here that led to this fight here at Summit Springs. Now, when the fight then went into the bluffs in here, this is where the fight went on for a good 20 minutes, and there would be about 25 warrior dead in, right up in here. As the fight unfolded, it soon was in here, in these canyons, where the major part of the fight occurred. And Talbot retreated with about 25 warriors down in these canyons this way, and they all lost their lives in about a 20-minute fight. Talbot's killed about where we're standing right here.
Now, Roman Nose was dead. Talbot was dead. Black Kettle was dead. Of those Indian leaders who remained, most went south to live on reservations set aside for them in Indian territory. In the 21st century, many Cheyenne live on reservations in Oklahoma and Montana. However, in 1870, a few Cheyenne, under the leadership of Dull Knife and Little Wolf, remained with their Sioux cousins in the north and would fight in the battle for the Black Hills. At this popular tourist attraction here in south central Montana, in what is now known as the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or Custer's Last Stand, three famous and heroic figures of the Indian Wars came together: Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, and Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. In an odd way, it was the battle that decided who would rule the Northern Plains once and for all. The western tribe of the Sioux Indians, known as the Lakota, had dominated the northern plains for over a century. As a warrior culture, they were unparalleled horsemen and fierce in battle. Among their warriors was an uncanny strategist, a young man known for his strange ways, with a name that reflected his strangeness, Tashanka Witko, Crazy Horse. Born in 1849, Crazy Horse, at age 13, had already raided the Sioux's traditional enemy, the Crow. Still just a 17-year-old teenager, at the Fort Phil Kearny massacre, he was one of the decoys that led Captain Fetterman's patrol into an ambush. After the Fetterman massacre, Crazy Horse studied the ways whites fought. Going into the Black Hills, he sought visions that would tell him how to defeat the U.S. cavalry. As a result, he became one of the Sioux's most successful military leaders. However, the foremost chief among the Sioux was a revered warrior and holy man, Iyotanka, known to the whites as Sitting Bull. As a young man, Sitting Bull earned a great reputation as a warrior, becoming a leader of the Sioux Strongheart Warrior Society. His courage made him a legendary figure in the Indian Wars. In the middle of a fight with soldiers on the Yellowstone River, Sitting Bull calmly smoked a pipe on the battlefield while bullets whizzed by him. After finishing, he cleaned the pipe and then casually walked back to the Indian lines. Colonel George Armstrong Custer was known to the Sioux as Hard Backsides Custer because he rode in the saddle all day and all night chasing Indians. Born in Ohio in 1839, he attended West Point. Though he graduated near the bottom of his class, he nonetheless won his spurs in the Civil War, and was given a brevet promotion to Major General because of his unflagging courage and lightning strikes against Confederate forces. At the Battle of Gettysburg, Custer's brigade routed General Wade Hampton's rebel cavalry, took Confederate prisoners, and captured artillery and supply trains. He was a genuine Civil War hero and fearless fighter. After the war, he stayed in the Army and was made Lieutenant Colonel in the 7th Cavalry. Custer soon learned firsthand how difficult it was to catch the nomadic Plains Indians and bring them to battle in an open fight. He quickly became a proponent of General Philip Sheridan's total war strategy, in which villages, non-combatants, and supplies became legitimate targets. He became a heroic figure to the white settlers for his relentless pursuit of Indian raiders. At the Battle of Washita, Custer used Sheridan's search and destroy strategy to its fullest. The Cheyenne chief Black Kettle, after surviving Sand Creek, moved between Kansas and Indian Territory. In Kansas in 1868, it was believed his warriors participated in devastating raids along the Saline and Solomon Rivers, killing about 40 citizens and carrying off captives. Sheridan sent Custer after the Indian raiders. Custer found Black Kettle wintering on the Washita River in central Oklahoma. On the gloomy morning of November 27, 1868, Custer's 7th Cavalry charged Black Kettle's camp from all four sides. They swept into the camp with guns, firing as the Indians fled from their lodges. In the end, the 7th Cavalry killed 103 Cheyenne, mostly women and children. Also dead was Chief Black Kettle. Custer lost 21 men. Just as the Sand Creek Massacre had angered the Cheyenne and Arapaho 4 years earlier, the Battle of Washita inflamed passions against Custer. Within 8 years, destiny would bring Custer, Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse together at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. In 1874, gold was discovered in the Black Hills of Wyoming and South Dakota. Once again, miners rushed into what was the heart of Sioux territory. By now, many of the earlier war chiefs, like Red Cloud, had settled into reservation life. However, led by Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, many other Sioux continued their ways of hunting and raiding off the reservations. At the beginning of 1876, the roving bands of Northern Cheyenne, Northern Arapaho, and Sioux were ordered back onto the reservations. When they failed to report, all-out war was declared by the U.S. military. In overall command were Generals Sheridan and Sherman. In the field were General George Crook and Lieutenant Colonel Custer. At first, this last phase of the battle for the Northern Plains went well for the Indians. At the Battle of the Rosebud, Crazy Horse dealt General George Crook his only defeat in the Plains Indians War. Then came the most famous battle in all of the Indian Wars, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. On June 25th, leading the 7th Cavalry, Custer, under orders to seek out and attack any Indians he found, got word of a Sioux encampment along the Little Bighorn River in southern Montana. But it was not a simple village. In reality, it held nearly 8,000 Indians and over 1,500 warriors gathered for their annual Sundance Festival. During the festival, Sitting Bull danced, bled himself, and stared at the sun for 3 days and then had a vision. Soldiers falling from the sky. A voice cried out to him, saying, "I give you these because they have no ears." Sitting Bull interpreted his vision to mean a great victory over the white soldiers. In a classic attack maneuver, Custer split his force of 617 soldiers, 30 scouts and 50 civilians, sending Major Marcus Reno and Captain Frederick Benteen to encircle the camp in order to crush the Indians in a pincer movement. But Reno was repulsed and Benteen never joined up with Custer. The daring Lieutenant Colonel was left alone as he charged the village. Without any support, Custer broke off his attack and raced for a nearby hill. There he waited for Reno and Benteen to appear. This decision proved fatal. The Sioux and Cheyenne warriors took the initiative, encircling Custer and his troops. The Indian circle grew tighter. Crazy Horse led several daring charges through the soldiers' lines, killing a number of Custer's men. As the battle wore on, Custer's hopes of reinforcement faded. Finally, at what was to be called Last Stand Hill, Custer and all his men were killed as the Indians refused to accept surrender. Though a stunning victory, this battle sealed the fate of the Sioux. Easterners who had once sympathized with Plains Indians now called for retaliation. In that fateful year, after the victory at Little Bighorn, the Sioux suffered one devastating defeat after another. Early in 1877, Crazy Horse's warriors were routed, and the power of the Sioux over the northern plains was broken forever. Sitting Bull finally surrendered in 1881. He later joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. In 1890, he was shot dead at Standing Rock by Indian police.
Custer, in the history of the Indian Wars, has sort of in modern times taken a bad rap for his personality. He was a well-known hero from the Civil War. His exploits were well-known there. When the 7th Cavalry was formed and he took that over as a lieutenant colonel after being a major general in the Civil War, they decided to make the 7th Cavalry the elite cavalry, and that was his charge. Even though he was second in command of the 7th Cavalry, the acting commander was never in field command. Custer was always in field command. And his actions at the Little Bighorn, if you sit and wonder how could, as he dies with about 225 men, and he attacks a village that is huge in size, as many as 2,000 warriors, and he attacks the center of the village with 212 men. What's going on? Well, if you look at his one Indian victory at the Washita in November of 1868, His success there was in capturing 53 women and children and using them basically as hostages to keep the other warriors from surrounding him. And I think a similar view could be looked at the Little Bighorn in his actions there. If he could get into the village soon and get the women and children before the warriors know what's happening, they won't attack him. But that didn't happen. And the disintegration of his command up there is one of the great mysteries of the Indian Wars. But I think it's a mistake to look at George Armstrong Custer as the sole cause of that. He had strategies, and he had care and compassion for his men. He had a very generous and kind heart. And for those who knew him, if you look through the historical accounts of the records of those who knew him, for every person that did not like his personality, you had 10 people that would follow him anyway.
Near this monument in southwestern South Dakota, the last battle of the Indian Wars took place. 14 days earlier, the last great Sioux warrior chief, Sitting Bull, was shot while being arrested by his own people. Warriors whose deeds had become legends, Roman Nose, Crazy Horse, and Little Crow, were gone. The nomadic way of life had vanished like the buffalo, swept aside by the winds of change. And on that day, December 29th, 1890, a massacre would mark the end of the battle for the Northern Plains, just as another massacre, the Grattan Massacre, had started it 36 years earlier. The place of this monument is called Wounded Knee. The rush toward a final reckoning began when the Paiute Indian Messiah, Wovaka, created a dance which he said would bring back the buffalo and the Indian dead to repopulate the plains and sweep the white man from the face of the earth. called the Ghost Dance by the Indians. It stirred fear in the hearts of ranchers, farmers, and townspeople across the West. Stories of the indiscriminate Indian retaliation were fresh in their memories. On the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the Ghost Dance had brought the Indians out into the December snows. Every night, they danced until they were exhausted, and it made troopers from the 7th and 9th Cavalry and the 8th Infantry uneasy. The Pine Ridge Indian agent, James McLaughlin, wired the federal government, urgently demanding protection. "Indians are dancing in the snow. They are wild and crazy. We need protection, and we need it now." On December 28th, the Sioux chief Bigfoot, sick with pneumonia, was returning to Pine Ridge with 350 followers after participating in a ghost dance. Units from the 7th Cavalry, Lieutenant Colonel Custer's old regiment, intercepted them and escorted the men, women, and children to the encampment at Wounded Knee, where an army doctor cared for Bigfoot and the Indians bought supplies. The next morning, reinforced with artillery, the 7th Cavalry commander, Colonel James W. Forsyth, ordered Bigfoot's band to disarm. During negotiations, a scuffle started with a Sioux medicine man, Yellow Bird, and a rifle shot thundered in the crisp winter air. Forsyth's troops opened fire. Hotchkiss guns raked the camp. Some warriors grabbed their weapons and returned fire as the Indians fled. When the battle ended, 128 Sioux were dead, including Bigfoot and Yellow Bird. Often portrayed as a massacre, the battle was not as one-sided as it seemed. The 7th Cavalry lost 25 men and 35 were wounded, the second highest casualties in battle for the 7th Cavalry in all the Indian Wars. Later, it has been speculated that some of these casualties may have been caused by friendly fire. To the settlers on the Great Plains, Wounded Knee was a great victory that heralded the end of a 40-year reign of terror by the Plains Indians. Over 100 years later, the Sioux Nation still survives on 15 reservations scattered across their old hunting grounds. Buffalo have begun a comeback. The old Sioux ways of living are enjoying a revival, cherished by Indians and whites alike. An interest in the longest American war has never been greater.